coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody. How you doing this Tuesday night? Chris Jordan here, coming at you live from North Austin, Texas. Hope everything has been going okay with you guys this week. I am getting ready for a nice little stint on the road coming up. I guess not on the road. I've got a local show coming up. So here next Tuesday, we will be live with Dr. Scott Taylor talking about binaural beats, brainwave frequencies, things like that, as well as King Gerhard in the second part. Speaking of King Gerhard, tomorrow, if you are in San Antonio, stop on by the Symposium of the Strange. Symposium of the Strange is brought to you by Curious Events, as well as King Gerhard, Ryan Edwards, and Rod Nichols. We are out there doing a great speaker series, so you can come on out, hear some stuff about Bigfoot in Texas, hear some stuff about Sasquatching and new evidence that's out there, all kinds of things. Meet the authors, ask questions, all kinds of great stuff. So Symposium of the Strange, folks, symposiumofthestrange.com is where you can go to find out more information about that. Our guest in the first section is Brad Olson. He is a friend of the show from back in our old incarnation, actually. So Brad is a researcher in the world of the esoteric. He is a researcher in the world specifically of Antarctica secret bases. He was recently at MUFON Symposium in DFW speaking about SAME. He has a new documentary on forbidden knowledge, secrets of Antarctica. Welcome back to the show, Brad Olson. How are you doing?
Hey there, Chris. I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me back on the Curious Realm.
Well, it's always good talking with you, man. It was great seeing you at MUFON, and the panel that you were on was pretty cool. Going into secret bases, not only in Antarctica, but of course in off the coast of California, things like that. How did you first come into this world of study, Brad?
Well, this is what I call esoteric history. It's the kind of history that not many people know about. We're not taught about in school, but groups like MUFON is very instrumental in collecting this information. And as you mentioned, the panel I was on was about underwater archaeology, underwater craft coming up out of the water, and all sorts of strange things under the water. And you just don't really get that kind of information, not even at other UFO conferences. So that's what I really appreciate about the MUFON group, is they are actively out there collecting this information, people out in the field checking out the stories, finding out what's real, putting it into a database. And then that database is really incredible for doing other kind of presentations. For example, on Saturday night, somebody took all of the MUFON studies about portals opening up. That was really fascinating. I never thought about how many witnesses have seen portals. So that's what's cool about that group, is they do have so much information and studies and sightings in their database for people to pull from.
I'm a lifetime member of MUFON. I'm a huge supporter. I'm a conference sponsor for the symposium. And one of the big reasons is because they are one of the longest lasting intakes of data like that. They have a compendium of data now available through Project Aquarius, things like that, that is just massive, from newspaper clippings to all kinds of stuff that's out there and available. And the one thing I keep saying, Brad, is those are the things that I love AI for, because you can use very specific AIs that, like, you could pump that information in and it won't draw from Google. It'll only draw from the data sets you give it. So it's like, yeah, you could really start finding some patterns in sightings and experiences and things like that that may not have been found before. You know, it's really exciting stuff when you start looking at the data catalog that they have.
And all the subjects that they have too, including animal mutilations was another presentation. And then all the latest best evidence of what has happened in the previous year.
Yeah.
So you can tell that this is something that's not going away, Chris. This is something that happens year after year after year. And so the good people at MUFON take it upon themselves. Most are volunteers to compile this information and keep it in a accessible database that all the rest of us can draw from.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. You know, and in that database are things like Antarctica and sightings of underwater vehicles, sightings of underwater bases, all kinds of stuff. So let's go ahead and start kind of cracking the nut, so to speak, of underwater bases, Brad, and specifically bases around Antarctica, and how these may relate to things that you've seen through your world travels that might go back to what would be considered like a master builder race across the globe.
Yeah, that's a casting a wide net there, Chris. I'll answer them one at a time. And as far as underwater artifacts at Antarctica, one of the best known is the Eltonen antenna, which is discovered quite by accident right underneath the very deep water between the southern tip of South America and the Palmer Peninsula. And indeed, that's the route that I took via sailboat 5.5 years ago down to the Palmer Peninsula. So it could be an ET antenna, could be the Nazis put it in for their submarine fleet going down there, or it could be the US or another government military putting this antenna down there. But it's quite clearly fashioned by a higher intelligence, just as are these megaliths around the world. Clearly a worldwide phenomenon of a builder race, as you mentioned, that created these megalithic structures with polygonal architecture. That means multi-angles and then fitted together very precisely into these megalithic structures that still exist today. And some of them are very, very old.
Let's start getting into some of those examples real quick, Brad, of that construction technique that you're talking about.
Sure. I do a whole presentation on the builder race and megaliths around the world, and I draw from hundreds of slides that show these constructions worldwide. And the thing that really brings them all together is this similar style of construction, this polygonal architecture. So let's start in South America, and you have the city of Cuzco in Peru, which is at 11,120 feet in elevation. I mean, first of all, it's way up there, pretty much at the top of most of our mountains in North America, at least out west here. So the elevation is just incredible. Then you go up above Cuzco, which is totally chock full of these megalithic builder race constructions, and you have this site called Sacsayhuaman, truly one of the most mysterious sites in the world. If you ever have the opportunity to go to Peru, you would certainly be making your way up to Sacsayhuaman. It's right up there with Machu Picchu and Ollantaytambo, other sites that have this incredible megalithic rock work that is so evident when you tour these sites. We're talking about 20, 30, 50 ton blocks with this absolute precise fitting, this configuration. I'm glad you pulled up that picture, Chris.
Absolutely.
You can see what is known as the marshmallowing technique.
Yeah.
And also on the, look at the block on the lower right there. It's like you can see the trowel mark.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they soften these stones to the point that they were malleable and could fit them when they're wet.
Yeah.
Almost like cement.
Well, and it's interesting because when you start getting into that, and even the concept, Brad, of perhaps they had some kind of geopolymer technology that they used, something like that. And even the idea of this construction technique itself being akin to corn, which was held sacred by most native tribes in the Americas. You know, it was not only a staple crop, but a sign of their gods. So the idea that this whole construction technique is kind of based on the same geometric polymer construction of a ear of corn is interesting to me. You know, that they lean directly on nature around them to pull that from.
That's a good point. And they also use different color stones to recreate images of animals. And you do see quite frequently images of the snake, of the water, the puma of the land, and the condor bird of the sky. And they will create megalithic stones that fit right into the walls of a different color, clearly depicting these animals of air, earth, and water. So, again, it's just such a mystery, not only how they were built, how they were moved to the site, how they were fitted together so expertly, but also how old they are. And indeed, in Cuzco and many other locations of South America, the Incas were reported to have told the Spaniards, "We found the foundations of these megalithic buildings and we just built upon them."
Yeah.
And indeed, you can see the Incan architecture and the Spanish architecture, sometimes all three in one building.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite clear that the oldest, the megalithic, is the best built. And they do get hit by a lot of earthquakes down there. So a lot of those, especially the Spanish mortar built buildings, will come crumbling down. And there's an example of Incan, not so precise fitted stone without mortar, with megalithic older stones all around it and underneath it.
And you know, to see the fact that, yes, these things are fitted without mortar, they're massive in size. And once again, seem to have an appearance because it's not like they've been worked in a standard fashion. You don't really see tool marks, chisel marks, things like that. It looks as though they have been extruded from a form. It's really fascinating to look at.
I had the great opportunity of going down there with Nassim Harriman, who's a new physicist with new ideas about these constructions, among other subjects that he covers, as well as Brian Forrester, who's a total expert on these sites. And they were talking about a building technique called cold plasma, where they would render these stones not quite liquid or clay form, but almost solid, but malleable enough to use this cold plasma technique to mold them into place. And you mentioned also that they could be poured concrete. There's some evidence of some of the stones at Pumapunku that show signs that they're poured concrete. But in all cases, we're talking about technology that really has either been lost to us or is now being suppressed, and we're not getting the full answer as to how they were able to do this. And
not only that,
but it's also auditive levitation, where they might have been able to move these massive blocks by matching the resonant frequency and moving them over into place.
And I will definitely say I appear on a lot of shows talking about binaural beat frequency, just the science of frequency and the way that our body resonates with frequency and responds to it. And, you know, we forget that, once you start getting into high order frequencies, octaves of frequencies, things like that, you start getting some really interesting effects on physical matter. The Hutchison effect is a prime example. I'm trying to remember his first name, but Hutchison in Canada did the experiments in his garage and playing with RF fields and other high order frequencies, and literally had, you know, steel bars that bent in half like they were licorice ropes, things like that, things that would levitate, you know, like solid steel balls that would levitate, and, you know, you'd touch them and they look like moving water. Just wild things like that. So yeah, absolutely. Once you start getting into the world of manipulation of frequency, it is a totally different space, you know? And you're playing with matter at that point. I mean, we're all 90% empty space, Brad. We are just frequency.
That's so right. We respond to frequency, as does other matter. So an example I often give when I talk about auditive levitation is, consider how an opera singer can shatter a wine glass with her voice. Nothing more. That's just the frequency of her voice doing it. So just scale that up to the next level. If you were to match the resonant frequency, and again, we all have that. We are our own resonant frequency. Every piece of matter is as well. If you can match that resonant frequency, the Tibetans showed how acoustic levitation works. They had a Swedish scientist out there. I profile this story in my book, Future Esoteric, in the Forbidden Sciences chapter, that they were able to move these giant blocks of stone up a high ledge in the mountains just by using musical instruments and their voice chanting in a semicircle around the stone. And when their voice and musical instruments culminated to a certain climax, the boulder would start shaking, and then they would all lift their heads up right when the boulder started levitating, and then they would astrally project the stone up the cliff face, then with their minds too. So I think that's really fascinating as well. It's not just, in this case, the auditive levitation, but also their ability to also project mentally where they want the matter to go.
Well, and to physically alter space around them, through vibration and through the use of vibration, you know, and even through hitting that resonant frequency themselves. And that's something that we speak about regularly on the show. Even when it comes to alien life, you know, things like that, paranormal, all of that, Brad, we see and hear a very minuscule slice of that white light spectrum, you know, that makes up total tons of stuff, and the electromagnetic spectrum beyond that, infrared, ultraviolet, gamma rays, everything else. We are almost blind amongst the entire electromagnetic spectrum as to what we actively see and hear.
And we are, because when you look at on the visual spectrum, there is ultraviolet on one side, infrared on the other, as well as the auditory range, just like we can't hear a dog whistle.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, specifically with acoustic vibrations, frequencies, things like that, there are numerous examples of that being used in ancient temple complexes across the globe.
Right. And that's what's so cool, especially if you go to, say, Gothic cathedrals in Europe or ancient temples. There's always a spot that the acoustics is really pronounced, where you can hear an echo, where you can hear a voice projected across the room, even a whisper. Mm-hmm. And it seems like they all had that in mind when they built these old constructions, that acoustics would play a very major factor. Just like, for example, if you go to an ancient Greek or Roman amphitheater, of course, this is back in the day when there was no amplified sound, there were no speakers and ways to project the voice. So those amphitheaters had to be perfectly shaped so people's voice would carry up to the top rows. And indeed they do. And we tried that out.
Oh, yeah.
There's a site in Peru called Moray with these concentric rings, and it was perfect acoustics there too.
And you know, when you start looking at the way in which they literally changed the hill face, things like that, when you look at the, you know, the Theater of Epidaurus, that kind of stuff. I remember going to Greece and having my history professor strike a match on stage and hearing it like in the upper deck, like, wow. Like it was standing next to you, a wooden match, like, remarkable. As an audio engineer, it was just one of those like, wow, no speakers, utter just straight geometry and using the space around you properly, you know. And it's really interesting. Yeah, one of the things we discuss regularly with people like Jared Murphy is the idea that, you know, it doesn't have to come from anywhere except for the right here. Like, we have forgotten our own history. Like you said, even a master builder race, somebody who taught all of these other civilizations that this other knowledge came from, we've forgotten our own history numerous times over on this planet.
And that's why it's esoteric history, because it's only known by a select few. And those select few sometimes don't want to share that information with others, because look how advanced we would be as a civilization if we continued to expand and grow with these technological achievements.
Yeah.
Well, our buildings would be megalithic stone block buildings, and we'd be moving stuff around with auditive levitation and take that to the next level and use it in transportation and energy. We wouldn't need to pollute this planet. We'd be flying cars instead of driving on roads by now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you look especially at places like Pumapunku, where the massive complex of stones laying out. This is the one you were saying earlier, look, where some things, especially what we're looking at here, kind of look like they are made out of concrete, like they've been made out of a reverse mold in art class or something like that, or like we're looking at the mold almost. And it's really fascinating to look at the precision in which these are made. Just remarkable stuff. And have you seen other sites around the globe that have come close to this kind of precision of construction, Brad?
Oh, well, yeah. In Egypt, you see it in the Great Pyramid, the Valley Temple, Abydos, a lot of examples of megalithic architecture that the older it gets, this is what's so curious in this realm to me, Chris, is that the older some of these architectures are, including Pumapunku, including the Great Pyramid, the better constructed they are, the higher level of technology that went into their building. And indeed, for example, all along the Nile River, there are other pyramids, especially up near the Great Pyramid in Saqqara. Some of them are newer pyramids, and they're literally just piles of rubble. And here you can see at Sacsayhuaman, the Incan building, clearly inferior to the megalithic building. So usually you would think that history would work the other way around, that you would start in a very archaic way of building and then reach the pinnacle later on. But quite opposite here.
Well, it's quite opposite, period. You know, yeah. I mean, even whenever you look at us, we've just now, this year, figured out the actual formula for Roman concrete. Mm. Just figured it out. That it's been around for a hot minute now. and those buildings are still standing. You know, the aqueducts still have water flowing through them. Like the concrete set while the water was flowing. Mind-boggling stuff. Like they were literally setting concrete underwater in Roman time.
That's amazing.
It's phenomenal to think about scientifically, and the fact that we have just mastered it, just figured out how they made concrete that lasts that long, because ours does not. There was a whole series about 5 years ago or so on Discovery Channel, like The World Without Man. And it basically extrapolated out like, hey, here's bustling Chicago. Let's check it out. What happens to Chicago without humanity? And they start extrapolating it out year by year. Like after about 10 years, you know, the facade will start falling down. Nobody's maintaining it. Nobody's cleaning it. Nobody's doing this. And after about 20 years, like plants are growing out of the high rises and like nature has begun taking over the city again, you know, the same way that we LIDAR the jungle and find entire complexes now and have realized that these cultures in Guatemala and Mexico and South America were entirely connected via a network.
Yeah. You know? And some other examples, even in this modern age, is some of the sites that have experienced nuclear radiation fallout, such as Chernobyl.
Yeah,
was a whole city around the nuclear power plant that got evacuated. As you mentioned, the buildings start deteriorating, nature starts taking over, and wild animals start moving back in.
Yeah, yeah, and they're changed.
Yeah,
it's pretty remarkable to see it, and to see how nature literally just comes right back and takes it over, and how fast. Once again, our stuff gets utterly destroyed, you know, rebar or everything else. It's pretty fascinating exactly how fast our civilization would just crumble to dust and almost disappear, Brad. We would not have things like the pyramids, you know, that last tens of thousands of years.
I was just watching some of the Summer Olympics, which is in Paris this week with my dad. We're checking out some of the beach volleyball, and it's right at the base of the Eiffel Tower. Did you know that until the Eiffel Tower was built in the 19th century, the Great Pyramids were the tallest structure on the planet? Yep. Even the top of the spires of the Gothic cathedrals didn't get to that height.
Yeah.
So, again, I think the ancients had some kind of technology and some knowledge, know-how.
Yeah,
and we're just still playing catch-up to see
Absolutely.
How they did it.
Absolutely. You know, and a great example of that, going right down to Florida, near where you're going, is Coral Castle. Yeah. You know, the immigrant who built an entire structure dedicated to the woman that he loved by himself. Out of multi-ton chunks of coral. Nobody ever saw the guy. He didn't just block and tackle.
Yeah.
That's it. One dude, he was not like Popeye, or he wasn't even like your height, Brad.
No,
you know, you'd think he'd be like a large strapping man. Like, no, he was like 5'2", 5'3", like tiny little Eastern European immigrant, and moved these multiple ton blocks by himself and literally claimed that he had found the technology that helped build the Great Pyramids. Which, yeah, I think that we're going to be having Stephen Myers on. I love talking with him about the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation and the idea of possibly moving things into place using water locks.
Yeah.
And flooding the Nile. Like, it makes perfect sense. Why, if you've already mastered the Nile and you already know how to build dams, why would you take it off a barge just to drag it across the dirt by a mile? Like, why not just flood the place? Build it like that.
Off the water.
You know? Yeah. So, yeah, it's interesting. And it's interesting to think that we are an ingenious and intuitive species, and we figure out things all the time that we readily forget, you know, and technologies that we forget. We find tools all the time that ancient man used that we have no idea what they're used for. And even looking once again at places like Pumapunku, where there are massive stones that have very intricate carving in them. Almost
drill holes.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, like perfectly round drill holes, perfectly milled holes. And I'm not saying you can't do it with hand tools. But that'd be tough. That'd be very, very tough to do with hand tool. So what they used, how they used it, the techniques they used, I don't know, but it's pretty remarkable to see the results.
Yeah, it sure is. I'm friends with Chris Dunn. He's written several books about Giza, and he's been down to South America many times with his instruments. He's a master stone builder, and he'll do measurements and take really high-resolution photographs, even including inside some of those round holes. And you can actually see sometimes the spiraling of a drill bit. Certainly no chisel could have made some of those shapes. And then the cut marks with some kind of saw that can cut through granite and other stone.
Yeah.
Back to the coral castle, the little guy, Edley Scalian, who built it. Yeah, all he said was he knew the secrets of how they built the Great Pyramids, and that he was modeling his building technique, probably employing auditive levitation. But did you know that the coral castle is the only megalithic structure of the 20th century? Built by this guy single-handedly.
Really?
Oftentimes in the middle of the night. Yep, the only one.
Interesting. And I guess nobody put the Georgia Guidestones in that category.
Well, those were machine shop built.
I guess that's true. That's true, yeah.
And they were built with a crane, and while they were of a large size, it's pretty well known. I guess I should say megalithic in such a way that it was a mystery how he built it, how he moved those blocks, how he fitted them in shape.
And the techniques used as well.
Yeah.
You know, now, once again, no modern milling techniques, things like that.
No.
Everything rough hewn, all that kind of stuff. And even going back to the idea once again of the numerous layers of construction that exist at some of these locations where you see numerous civilizations building on top of each other. And once again, where the older they are, the more sturdy they are. It's pretty interesting to see that. And it brings up a lot to me. It reminds me a lot of America's Stonehenge in New Hampshire, and the idea, especially the stories of the settlers, whenever they came in and found it, and they asked the local native population, like, hey, what's this thing? Why'd y'all build it? They were like, we don't know. That was here when we got here.
That's right.
You know, we camp out there here and there, whatnot, but we didn't build that thing. We have no idea what that's used for, you know?
And a lot of people who visit the America's Stonehenge, well, you can clearly see that is an ancient megalithic site, huge capstones.
Yep.
They don't realize that all around New England are these beehive stone chambers, dozens of them that remain hundreds in times of antiquity. Most were just disassembled for use of a ready-made quarried stone that they would put into the fence walls and so forth. But yeah, America's Stonehenge, it's one of the biggest mysteries of the North American continent. And of course, having a name like that, there you go. It has sightings with the solstice, the equinoxes.
Yep.
Or you can tell the season of the year. And there are some of those megalithic capstones and then a sacrificial table that had grooves cut into it there on the lower left.
Yep.
Where they could have sacrificed an animal, maybe even a human, and drip the blood gravity into certain containers.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, a situation where the natives had no idea how it got there, you know, and they'd been around the area for quite a bit. So to see that once again, these civilizations have built upon civilizations that they've found, upon edifices that they've found as well, is really fascinating, because we gladly do the same thing, you know. Find a good foundation. There's no reason to get rid of it. You just utilize it.
Right. Why wouldn't you? Is a better rationale, because there you have a foundation ready to go. And that is so clear when you're in Cuzco. And Brian Forrester said that Ollantaytambo, which is this megalithic city where you catch a train to Agua Calientes, which is the town you stay in when you go up to Machu Picchu, he called it the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. And there you can also see megalithic foundations, Incan blocks, and then sometimes Spanish colonial on top of that.
And yeah,
those are very susceptible to earthquakes whenever there is an earthquake, and it's right on the Ring of Fire. So you get a lot of really severe earthquakes. One of the biggest in the world was right along the Humboldt Trench, South America. And other buildings come crumbling down, but these megaliths, part of the ingenuity of the design and construction is they can withstand these great big earthquakes too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's just it. Like that, even in ancient Greece, to see the fact that, because they lived on islands, like, you're gonna have earthquakes. It's gonna happen. And they figured it out, and they figured out an ingenious way. They actively made their columns sectional. And made them with a tongue and groove fashion, where there was a hole in the top and a nodule that came out of the bottom of, or out of the top of one, a hole in the bottom, and they fit together so that instead of being one solid column that cracked whenever the vibration happened, that they could shift and move and the building wouldn't fall over, you know. Absolutely phenomenal, ingenious to see that. That they built shock absorbers into their buildings. We didn't figure that out until the 50s, you know?
Right. And the tongue and groove is evident at Stonehenge in England as well. There's little knobs and then carved indentations that fit perfectly. And you also have the T-joints, which you see that a lot at these megalithic sites around the world. And they carve a T-joint into both sides and then pour molten metal to strengthen the joint too. The metal's been long picked away and gone, but the impression where the T-joint was still remains.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, these techniques are once again passed down all over the place. And it's interesting to see them similar applications in different areas, the same technique being used, but applied in a different way, you know. And now we've got you for about 15 more minutes. Let's move this conversation into the world of Antarctica. Brad, how have your research into these other civilizations, these other structures, led you to find possible things in Antarctica that might be evidence of a lost civilization down there?
Well, I wish I could tell you that I found some of that, but I was on a sailboat for 26 days. And while we did have the ability to take our dinghy ashore and check out a penguin colony or go to some of the research stations, didn't find anything like that, which I would have been in search of, as well as any ET artifacts or massive motherships or pyramids poking through the ice.
Yeah.
That's why I'd like to go back. And I'm working with a venture capital company called VC Cross to try to raise the funds to go down there and do a documentary and then go to all these places. I know where they're at and put together a whole movie on it. But in the meantime, I do my research on Antarctica, and I came out with a series on ForbiddenKnowledge.tv. That's Billy Carson's network, and forbidden is spelled with the number four. Mm-hmm. Knowledge, one word, .tv. And you can see my Secrets of Antarctica 8-part series, season one. We're in talks about doing season two. But meanwhile, I'm flying down there this weekend, and this new show, Secrets of Antarctica, has done so well. I've been nominated for TV Host of the Year.
Heck yeah.
That show. So I'll know on Sunday.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
That is awesome. Hard-earned and well-deserved. And once again, there have been hypotheses for quite a while now about possible structures in Antarctica. Like you mentioned a minute ago, the very large what appears to be pyramid in Antarctica, the antenna in Antarctica, things like that. Let's start going through a few of those in our last few minutes, Brad.
Sure. Yeah, and the one that's been featured on Ancient Aliens, and most people have seen the perfect four-sided pyramid poking through the ice. That's in the Ellsworth Mountain Range in West Antarctica. I know where it's at. In fact, I was talking to a group, an outfitter that can fly pretty much anywhere with a budget, and I was showing them all my pictures, and they were giving me an evaluation of what they knew about it, and I showed them the pyramids in the Ellsworth Range, and they said, well, they just dismissed it as a nunatak, which is just an attractive mountain under the ice. And I said, that's interesting. Why do you think that? He said, well, we fly over it on our way from Union Glacier to Vincent Massif, which is the tallest mountain in Antarctica, where a lot of people who have already climbed the tallest peaks on other continents want to round it out and do all seven continents.
Right.
I said, well, you call it a nunatak, you dismiss it as being intelligently fashioned, but have you stopped there? Have you climbed it? Have you taken any samples? He said, no, we just fly over it, point it out to people, and it's this very interesting four-sided mountain. That's all they think. So I think the jury's out on that. It certainly does qualify for further examination, and I would like to be the one to do that. And there are so many other locations. So Linda Moulton Howe is a colleague of mine, as well as Dr. Michael Sala. Three of us speak extensively on Antarctica. And Linda has whistleblowers who have told her about some of these crashed motherships, and supposedly there are three of them that are huge, 3 miles across, and they're called the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria, the nickname for the three. I've been able to pinpoint one of them in the Conan base in the old New Schwabenland, German claim. Linda has pinpointed the one in the Beardmore Glacier by Spartan 1 and 2, some of her whistleblowers. And we think the third is up on the polar plateau, and got some images or reconstructions of each of those, including Google Earth of the Conan base. So also to check out where the Nazis set up their base 211, which is what is known as an Antarctic oasis. So because of geothermal activities and all the volcanoes down there in 90, when I wrote my presentation 5 years ago, 91 known volcanoes. Now it's up to 93. So new discoveries continue to be made down there, which make it one of the most dynamic places on Earth and some of the last mysteries to really be discovered. So I think it would really make for a fascinating documentary. And this company, VC Cross, is raising some money. And yeah, we'd go to Hitler's frozen base, Base 211 in New Schwabenland, which is near the Schumacher Ponds, these lakes that never freeze, and a temperate land right along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is a volcanic chain under the Atlantic Ocean all the way up to Iceland, which is nicknamed the land of fire and ice, just like Antarctica is the land of fire and ice.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, to know that, science has said that, you know, there is a completely preserved forest under Antarctica, you know, under the many miles of ice that's there, that, you know, the methane and things like that seem to show the fact that, like, yeah, there is it was like a massive veldt of Greenland that used to be there at one point. So we know that the poles shift, things change. I mean, we're in the midst right now of a massive polar shift going on. Now, it's not like the world flips on axis or something like that, but we've been through micro ice ages, microclimates, all kinds of things over the last 10,000 years. So to think about what's happened over the last 100,000, something like that, over the last couple million, we're constantly moving back the timeline of humanity. It's constantly truly changing.
And while the magnetic poles are on the move like they've never been before in recorded history, the magnetic South Pole is now off of the Antarctic continent, and the magnetic North Pole is racing towards Siberia. If there was the flip of the poles, you'd know it, and that would be a pole shift, and it would certainly trigger volcanoes and tsunamis and earthquakes worldwide. Continents would rise and fall. New islands would appear. Others would disappear under the waves. And keep in mind, we live on an ocean planet. 71% of the surface of Earth is water. So water would play a big factor in the erosion and the movement of the continental landmasses. And indeed, as you mentioned, there have been found megafauna and megaflora in the fossil record of Antarctica, namely a location called Mount Buckley, which is at the top of the Beardmore Glacier, which I would really like to go to as well on this documentary, because dinosaur bones, which can only live in very warm climates, including some species of dinosaurs that are only found in Antarctica, proving that it must have been a sweltering jungle at one time, because the fossils have ferns and other tropical plants, and dinosaurs, which are cold-blooded lizards and need the warmth to exist. So clearly Antarctica or the poles moved over this landmass and then flash froze it to the point we're at today. So what could be under the ice could really be the trigger for global disclosure.
Yeah.
And I think that's why this is an esoteric subject. I think some people know this.
Yeah.
But keeping it from the rest of us because they're still backward engineering technology or just don't think humans can handle that or whatever reason. But it's wrong and we should know and we have a right to know.
Well, and it's something, you know, even right now, speaking of the megafauna thing, just the other day I posted this article from SciNews. A new study has confirmed that humans played a key role in megafauna extinctions. So we've been at it for a hot minute, bud. For all those that think that, like, oh no, megafauna and humans didn't roam the earth at the same time, we absolutely did. We helped drive them to the point of extinction, man. Well,
woolly mammoths, which have been with spear points in their bone, and
well, this is like giant armadillos. This goes back beyond the point of woolly mammoth. This is like they were butchering giant armadillos and stuff like that in South America. So it goes back pretty far. It's pretty interesting to see. And once again, the idea that our society, our humanity has been reinvented numerous times, Brad, numerous times. The idea that the timeline of humanity keeps getting pushed back and that technologies seem to keep burgeoning from it. It's pretty interesting to see.
It is indeed. And I also do a presentation at conferences on the giants and the evidence found worldwide for them. Another esoteric subject because it keeps getting covered up. One location out in the Channel Islands of California, I think it's on Santa Rosa Island, they found a cave overhang that was charred for many, many years, decades, even centuries of fires. And in this pit where giant bones were also found, they found the remains of dwarf mammoths that were butchered on the Channel Islands, although probably during the last ice age, they connected to the mainland. So these animals could come and go, as well as the humans or these giant species. And they found the dwarf mammoth bones had saw marks in them. The people were roasting them on the fire and then eating them, just like we would have a T-bone steak with your knife cutting off the meat. And this is another piece of history that has just been swept under the rug. And as I say in my talk on the giants, I just find it so disturbing that I have to be the one to tell people about this, because once I present the evidence, I think people come away saying, oh yeah, clearly the bones don't lie. There were these elongated skulls. There are these giant figurines, much taller than humans today. And we're not talking about gigantism where a cancer growth on the pituitary gland. No, these were well proportioned. They lived long lives, much longer than humans, by the way. And incidentally, they were at war with the local population. The local population, Nevada, where I'm at, they were cannibals.
Yeah, Lovelock Cave.
But you can't be a cannibal. You see, you can't eat your own species. When they were feeding cow flesh to cows in England, they got mad cow disease.
Yep.
And this is called spongiform encephalitis, and humans get it too. If you eat your own kind, Mother Nature has a way of saying, no, you don't. Now you get this weird brain disease that'll eat your brains. But if you're a different species, you can get away with it.
Yep. Yep. And you know, these topics, Brad, these ideas, the ideas of not only a master race, but the connection of these structures across humanity, the connection of the technology that helped build these megalithic structures, even whenever you get into the idea of knowledge being hidden and secreted away, it's one of those that, it's hard for a lot of people to grasp what has been secreted away and how much has been secreted away when it comes to this stuff. But it's kind of along the same lines of, why does it matter that William Shakespeare written the dude that wrote William Shakespeare? You know, it kind of matters a lot. Is it going to take anybody's PhD? And I think that's where it comes down to, Brad, is people think that like their years of research is going to be ruined, that their PhD, that their, you know, everything will be taken from them. And it's like, no, you got your PhD because you put up a dissertation and you were able to defend it. It means like scientifically, you were able to give a hypothesis and prove the hypothesis. Like, that's great. We've forgotten the fact that sometimes the most important information in a scientific set of data is the data that we cull, Brad, you know, because it really, at that point, once you've culled enough data, the only thing you're left with is the anomaly to research. But you've got to be willing to even say that what we know that is, isn't.
Well, that's right. And that's what's called the scientific method.
Yeah.
So if I make a discovery and you're one of my colleagues, Chris, and I say, well, here you go, this is how I made that discovery. That way of achieving that discovery should be reproducible. And you should be able to do the same thing. And then other colleagues can do it as well. And then it becomes established science. And this would be the case with the giants. Now they're finding in every case where there's enough DNA to do a sample that they're finding that it had a human mother, matrilineal human DNA, but an unknown father. In every case, the star child skull with Lloyd Pye, with Brian Forrester and the Paracca skulls, and Klaus Dana got a giant bone in Ecuador. And the same results came with all three of those samples they tested. So, and then this kind of corresponds with the story of Genesis in the Old Testament of the Bible, that there were these giants, yep, these men of renown, and they saw the women, they were beautiful, and they mated with them, and they could have had offspring. And once again, it's like two species that are very similar, such as a donkey and a horse, can mate and actually have another species, a hybrid called a mule.
Yeah.
But the mule is sterile. And just in the same way that if the giants were cannibals, that they would avoid this sponge form encephalitis because the species were different.
Yeah. Yeah. They were divergent enough to make a difference.
To make a difference. And so then it kind of all starts to make sense. Then all the pieces of the puzzle start coming together. Then we could say maybe these giants were the Anunnaki and their offspring, this hybrid race, were the Nephilim, and they were much bigger and much taller, and they were taken as gods, living gods and lords, and they ruled the land. And here's the thing, Chris, maybe we should do a whole other show on this because we're running out of time.
They
may still be alive to this day in little pockets around the world.
Yeah. Let's definitely get together very soon and do an episode on that, Brad. I've had James Keenan on before talking about his work at Lovelock Cave and his work into giants in the Southwest. I'd love to have you on to talk about more of these stories specifically, not only throughout humanity, but across the globe of literal giants and the evidence that has been found for them. Man, I haven't had, that reminds me, I haven't had L.A. Marzulli on in a long time. So, man, thanks so much for coming on as always. It's always fantastic just chatting with you, talking with you about these very, very deep esoteric things. Where can people go to keep up with everything Brad Olson? Where can they go to find out more about Secrets of Antarctica, your amazing docuseries, which is up for an award at the Consciousness Awards this week? Congratulations on that. Where can they go to find your books other than our store, all that kind of good stuff, Brad?
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Yeah, to learn more about me and my conference schedule, bradolson.com, just spell below there. My books and my publishing company, and then other authors such as Laura Eisenhower and Michael Jaco, Leo Lion-Zagami, myself and others are on cccpublishing.com. If you get one of my books off this website, they go through my office, so I'm able to sign copies for people. And also, the Secrets of Antarctica can be found on forbiddenknowledge.tv. Yep, there's the URL, /secrets-of-Antarctica. And as you say, I'm nominated for the talk show host of the year, Giorgio Tsoukalos, who's
a
speaker on ancient aliens, is the host of the Conscious Awards. Of course, Billy and Elizabeth Carson will be there and many, many others. So looking forward to that this weekend down in Miami. There may still be tickets available, maybe last minute. So if any of your listeners are in the Miami area, come out to the Conscious Awards this weekend. It'll be great.
Heck yeah. Brad, thank you so much again for the time. I greatly appreciate it, my friend. I'll be sharing links for all this, all that kind of good stuff. Enjoy the rest of the time with your family up there.
Thanks, Chris. It was really great talking to you again. And we'll certainly have to go into the curious realms again with the giants real soon.
You bet. Take care, man. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. You bet.
Always fantastic talking with Brad Olson. His realm of knowledge when it comes to ancient civilizations their construction methods, and many of the connections between them is vast, vast, vast. So always awesome to sit back and talk with him about these things. When we come back from this break, everybody, we will be joined by Dan Hariri. We'll talk in the first part a little bit about the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance and the importance of trying to get Hollywood to change some of the way in which they approach the alien topic. And then we'll get into his new book, My Paranormal Life, and what a lifetime of paranormal events has led him to understand. We'll get into that right after this, folks. The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that short break. Thank you so much for all of your support. Thank you so much for hanging out through that break, especially thank you to WebWorks Wireless. WebWorks Wireless is your source for everything wireless when it comes to internet. If you have a camp, if you are a mobile broadcaster, if you have remote broadcast that you have to do from very remote locations, I have been using WebWorks Wireless since the beginning of Curious Realm. We have not had any drops. We have not had any issues, despite where we go in the country. As long as you have cell phone service, you have service. It's fantastic. Stop on by and check them out. WebWorks Wireless is your source for high-speed internet for all. Our guest in this segment is one of the founders of the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance, Dan Hariri. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing today?
Thank you very much for having me on. It's exciting. This is fun. I just started doing a new go-round of interviews the other day because I have two brand new books out, as you know. So yeah. Very nice to have you back, and thank you, and great to see you again, man.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you actually just got back from Contact in the Desert. How did all that go? I was a little disappointed not to make it, but incredible event. There were tons of great speakers, tons of amazing people that were there.
It was really quite remarkable, I have to say. My very first contact ever, Chris, was last year. I had heard about it for 20 years.
Yeah.
But I had never gone because I'll be honest, I had never even been to, I've lived in LA for 44 years, man. I've never been out to Palm Springs. I never made it out. I'm thinking, that sounds cool. All these people are there, but that's a three and a half hour drive, man. I don't know that I want to go.
Yep.
So last year, I had just befriended Stephen Bassett at UFO Con in San Francisco last year in March. And we became very good friends very quickly. I was promoting my book called After They Came, which you and I spoke about last year. And so I'm with Stephen Bassett, and he said, "Dan, you know, are you going to go to Contacting the Dead?" I go, "I don't want to schlep out to Palm Springs. It's a 3 or 4 hour drive." He goes, "No, Dan, you got to go. You got to go. You got to go. You got to go.
It's a happening.
It's happening, man. Everyone's there. I'll introduce you around. You got to go." I said, "Okay." So that was last year. He invited me. In fact, he even put me up in his room.
Oh, wow.
And he introduced me, Chris, to, you know, Nick Pope and Richard Dolan and Katie Page and Paul Hynek and Ron Janics and George Norrie. I mean, and I'm like, you know, I'm a kid in a candy store because I've been studying ufology since 2007, just as a personal passion hobby. So last year, Stephen invited me and I met all these amazing people. And I'm like, God, this is so cool, right? Cut to a year later, I am now the publicist. I've been a Hollywood publicist, as you know, for over 40 years. That's my profession.
Yeah, yeah.
So Steve Bousett introduced me to a gentleman named Ron Janics, J-A-N-I-X. Ron Janics is the co-owner, as of last year, of Contact in the Desert. Oh, he and I have become very, very close friends. So he hired me in November this past. And from November until a few weeks ago, I was working with him to help get speakers there and think of panels and to do pre-interviews. We did a ton of pre-press for the event, tons of pre-press. And then at the event, man, we had a million TV camera crews there. I got the LA Times there. First time in the history of Contact in the Desert ever, I got the LA Times. Huge article, Dan. So I was running around like a chicken without my head, as I was telling you before during your break, because I was running the media room as a publicist. And I also ran the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance booth, where a lot of very famous people were meeting guests and signing autographs. And then I did a lecture and a panel as a speaker and an author. So I was a kid in a candy store for a week. It was great.
Well, and you know, it really is incredible. It's one of my favorite things with Curious Realm is going out to the community events like that and really getting a chance to build bridges, talk to not only researchers, but experiencers at the same time. And that is really one of the big things about the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance is the outreach that they have to the media, the things that you guys are doing to try to not only bring filmmakers together, but to bring Hollywood together to try and understand not only the experiencer aspect of things, but the idea of maybe we have been presenting this in a really bad light for a while.
Well, that was a major theme at Contact in the Desert, certainly at my Hollywood Disclosure Alliance panel. At the panel, which I hosted, I presented, you know, how has Hollywood historically been representing the UFO phenomenon? And what do you think Hollywood should be doing moving forward to help the disclosure movement? And I had on that panel Steve Bousett, Paul Hynek, Katie Page, Michael Mazzola, David Foley, and Earl Grey Anderson, the head of MUFON LA. And to a fault, they all said, you know, historically, since the last 80 years of movies, almost every movie, Chris, and you know this, of course, the aliens come to kill us or eat us.
Yeah.
And you know, they're fiction, and they come to kill us or eat us. The famous, you know, I always bring this up. There's a famous Twilight Zone episode, To Serve Man.
Yep.
When aliens come to eat, literally to eat human beings, they have a book called To Serve Man. It's a cookbook, To Serve Man, which I think is so clever. So, and then we were trying to think of films that were showed the benevolent side, possibly. And we came up with four out of hundreds and hundreds. We came up with four: Close Encounters, E.T., The Arrival, and The Abyss. All other movies that anyone could think of, they come to kill us and eat us. So Hollywood has a long way to go to present. And it's exactly what you said, man, when you introduced this chunk. Steve Bassett and I created the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance 1 year ago to meld together two disparate groups of people. It's essentially UFO experiencers, researchers, and disclosure advocates, along with Hollywood writers, producers, directors, and performers.
Yeah.
So on the UFO side, these are people, including myself. And by the way, I saw my fourth UFO at Contact. I can tell you that story in a minute.
Oh, cool.
It just happened. It was on the last night of Contact. I always saw a beautiful UFO. Historically, these two groups have been operating at cross purposes. And then other than like a Steven Spielberg or James Cameron or a Scorsese or an M. Night Shyamalan, very few Hollywood insiders have really had any kind of inside track. Spielberg, of course, has. Mm. And J.J. Abrams, I'm sure, has as well. But very few Hollywood entities have taken the time to reach out to the UFO community, because, God, I personally probably have 200 friends who have had UFO or ET encounters. And I just got into this area in the last couple of years. There are thousands of people around the world, as you know, man, probably millions, who have had remarkable stories. Well, these are real stories, or at least they're real to the experiencers.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And I'll give you some examples. I am very good friends with a guy who lives in the Bay Area, very, very successful businessman. He's 60 years old. He's a good friend of mine. From the age of 5, he's been abducted by Pleiadian light beings every few years for 55 years. Okay. And he said they're beautiful and they're magnificent and they're kind, and they teach him, they're teachers. They teach him how to love his fellow man and how to be kind to planet Earth. And then he just told me this story the other day. 10 years ago, they told him to bring solar energy to Native American Indians living in the American Southwest. Solar energy, okay? And then, Chris, it gets better. They gave him, in his mind, they gave him an image of a, and I'm not a technical person, they gave him an image of a solar technology generating device as like a blueprint, like a diagram in his brain. And he hired some people that created this generation machine for solar energy. And he's brought it to many, many Native American tribes in the American Southwest, and he just got a multi-million-dollar grant to continue doing this. The extraterrestrials told him to do this, and he is, and he's doing incredibly well. Well, if that's not a magnificent story, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, it's interesting because there are numerous people who have had images transmitted to them, messages. Many people talk about messages being transmitted to them, specifically about the future of mankind, what we should do to care for the planet, what we should do to guard our DNA. It's pretty interesting when you start going through the similarities of cases like that. And like you said, unfortunately, it's not like most filmmakers or consultants for film reach out to people like NICAP or MUFON or other entities that have been out there intaking these cases for decades, you know.
Exactly. Well, yeah, again, that's what Hollywood Disclosure Alliance, HDA for short, we call it the HDA. That's what the HDA was designed to do. I know that. All right. So we have a dedicated Slack channel for all of our members, which I was telling you about a minute ago.
Yeah.
And in there, Chris, the UFO people and the Hollywood people are having lively discussions, robust discussions. Hey, you know, I just wrote a script. I need to interview some experiencers for accuracy.
That's great.
Or conversely, some UFO people say, hey, I just wrote a book about my experiences. I'm looking for an agent, or maybe someone can translate my book into a screenplay for me. And these things are starting to happen, and we're only a year old. We're just about we only launched in November, but we're about a year old. We have between 150 and 200 members. We grow every week.
I am proud to be a member with you guys.
You are. In fact, you literally are the newest member. So congratulations.
All right.
Welcome to the team. I'm glad to have you.
Well, it for me, because I mean, my show, Dan, is about demystifying topics. And that's why I like talking with researchers. That's why I like talking with people like Earl Grey. You know, Earl Grey is a very good friend of the show. And
one of my best friends.
And it's for me, that's the important part, is letting people understand all sides of the conversation, all facets of it. You know, it's hard to look at a gym and not understand that the sparkle of that gym comes from the facets that are there. If you don't look at the facets, then you're missing part of the gym, you know, and the experience, even the scientific method begins with observation. You know, it begins with an experience.
Right, of course. So, that's right. I think we're making remarkable human stories, or remarkable paranormal stories experienced by our fellow human beings. And I've met many, many people over the last 2 years who have become personal friends of mine, who have remarkable stories.
Yeah.
And I know these people. Now, look, you probably do. Every now and then I'll get I'm married to Bigfoot and I live in a tree in the forest. Okay, good luck to you. I don't know that you're insane or you're legit. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, we get some wacky people out there in the world. But by and large, Chris, the last 2 years, I've met some remarkable people who have extraordinary stories. So the ACA, we're trying to make these stories palatable to the Hollywood community. So at least, you know, have lunch. If you're a producer and you're looking for your night, have lunch with some. I know women who have been impregnated and had their fetuses taken.
Yeah.
On board craft. And then they go to their doctors. They say, what happened to my baby? Oh, you're not pregnant anymore. Well, where's the baby? Oh, no, I don't know what the baby is. Two women I know in particular, I'm friends mm-hmm. with. They've had babies taken by extraterrestrials.
Yeah. So we have had Karen Wilkinson, author of Stolen Seed, right here on this show. She lives right down the road. There are numerous stories like that. You know, even the concept right now, Dan, because we just had Earl on the show talking about the recent statements about the Betty Barney Hill case from Stephen Greer. And even approaching conversations like that, you know, and understanding the impact that statements like that and unhad conversations like that have within communities, what they do to impact experiencers, you know?
Yeah, of course. And you had Kathleen Martin on, I think, recently.
Yeah, and that's just it. I had seen the, for me, as someone in the media and someone who, once again, wants to demystify topics and really open the conversation across the aisles, it was like, hey, Kathleen Martin, has anybody asked you to come on a show and respond to Dr. Greer's statement about your aunt and uncle's case? You know,
I'll be honest with you, Chris. I didn't hear about that. What did Greer say? Because I didn't hear that.
He came out on, and I can't remember offhand. Feel free to fact check me, folks. You're always welcome to. But he came out on, I believe it was his show, and basically said that the Betty and Barney Hill case was a case of implanted memory, and that it was the members of a U.S. Air Force battalion that used technology, kidnapped them, collected DNA, and implanted memories.
Wow.
There's been hypotheses about those programs in communities for a long time. However, yes, as I've said numerous times since then on this show, Dan, that is a big tater to stand on the corner and talk about. And to say, well, hey, everybody, yeah, look, just, especially from somebody in the community like Stephen Greer. And when we did the episode, even Kathleen Martin was like, I respect the work of Stephen Greer. Even Earl Grey was like, I respect the work. Even I've said, I respect the work of Stephen Greer. Absolutely. You know, much of the disclosure movement as we know it would not be here without some of his work. And that's truth. But this was one of those like, wow, this is a divisive statement in the community.
Oh yeah.
You know,
that's huge. Yeah. You know, I didn't hear that at all.
Yeah.
I agree with you. Stephen Greer, and Steve Bassett and Danny Sheehan, those guys, they're, yeah. they're, you know, they're out with machetes thrashing the wheat, the tall weeds.
Absolutely.
For the rest of us.
And, and his work with Michael Schrat, all kinds of things. I mean, his work stands alone when it comes to disclosure, quite honestly. And he's been doing the press corps events for decades now.
Yes,
so it was one of those like, wow. And you know, even Kathleen was like, I think this may be a case where he's following a line of disinformation from some people. You know, and maybe even one of those cases, Dan, where disinformation has been injected from a reliable source in the community to cause disruption.
Did he cite that he had any proof for these new claims at all?
Don't know offhand. Didn't. Yeah. But it was a big one. It was a big one when it hit a couple weeks ago. And it was like, wow.
Wow. I missed that. That entirely.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
As a day one fan of the X-Files, and I think I've seen every episode three times at least, many of the X-Files episodes, as you'll know, were, you know, you watch them as the viewer and you go, okay, are those aliens or is that the government? And even Mulder and Scully, in some of the cases, when they see and witness things, and they come out, they're like, was that real? Or were we meant to see that? Or was that staged for us? So there is a line for sure. But the Betty and Barney, that's like a bedrock.
It's a cornerstone.
Story.
Yeah, no,
it was a cornerstone.
It was a seminal case.
Yeah, for that to change. I spent about an hour with Travis Walt at Contact in the Desert.
Wow.
And this guy is the most humble.
Yep.
I mean, I was like, me and my friend Lisa, we were bonding with Travis Walton for an hour.
Yeah.
And this guy, man, completely sincere, completely authentic, genuinely a nice, soft-spoken, kind person, right? And he's telling us what happened on the craft and how no one believed him.
Yeah.
People thought his brother had murdered him, he told me.
Yeah,
even his mother wasn't sure if his own brother had murdered him.
And you know, that is one of the cases that I quote regularly because, these things get very hyped in communities, Dan. And people, I think, get very carried away with the idea of, I wish I could have that experience. I don't know if you would want that experience.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
But beyond maybe seeing a light move in the sky at a very sharp distance, I don't know that you would want the experience that's in most of the books behind me. That it doesn't start off well for most of the people in the books, you know.
But if it came out that, you know, Pascagoula or Travis or Betty and Barney or some of these were military implants. Well, oh my, well, that just takes the whole thing to way outer limits, to whole other levels of insanity, right?
Yeah. 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 And you know, I'm not going to say that once again, those hypotheses and communities have not been out there, all kinds of things. But it's a big one. And it was one of those, like, did we have programs like MK Ultra alive and active at the time? Yeah, sure. We did.
Yeah, in the 50s.
Absolutely. In the 50s. You know, yeah. But I don't know that there was enough of a trope in society of alien abduction for that to be the implanted memory. You know, like if you're shooting for an implanted memory that it's like, how popular was the concept of alien abduction for people to even think about it? So
it seemed to me a couple of things. Betty and Barney, right? They were an interracial couple in 1961. That was not commonplace, not even close. In fact, it was illegal in many U.S. states. Illegal.
Yep.
So it seems to me that extraterrestrials might be looking down. Who can we study? They see an interracial human being couple and think, wow, we've never seen that. I'll tell you the truth. Until I went to college in my early 20s, I didn't see interracial couples.
Yeah.
I didn't grow up with that. There were no black people, African-American people, even in my whole neighborhood when I was a little kid. So that's perhaps that had the curiosity. But if you hear Betty and Barney's hypnosis tapes, which you've heard, the audio tapes when they're under hypnosis.
Yeah.
These people, I mean, especially Barney, he's terrified. Now, did our military, like, how do you do that? How do you implant terror? Like, I don't know.
It would be interesting. But yeah, I don't know. Once again, but that's just it. And that's the idea, is that we need to have these conversations. We need to openly have these conversations between media and experiencers. That kind of stuff.
Exactly right. And that's why people like you would be a great addition to the HDA. And anyone who's out there listening right now, please check us out. He has the banner up on the site here. It's HollywoodDisclosureAlliance.org, and you can read about all the members and our activities and contact page at the back. You can contact me or Stephen Bassett if you want to become a member. This, that photo, Chris, that was just the contact, that panel.
Oh, yeah.
That was my panel at contact. So that's me in the middle there. This is just a month ago. And it's Earl Grey Anderson from the left, Michael Mazzola, who directed and produced Unacknowledged with Stephen Greer.
Yep.
And then Paul Hynek with the blue jacket. To my right is David Foley, the comedian. He has the podcast Really with Tom and Dave.
Yep.
The blonde lady is Katie Page, who's become a very dear friend of mine. And at the end there is Stephen Bassett, my partner. So that was a hell of a good panel.
Yeah. And I mean, we've had Stephen on a few times. We have Earl Grey on a few times.
These are the people that carry the water, you know. These are the guys that are carrying the water for us.
I think that bears to be said also, Dennis, that a lot of people do not realize the folks that are behind the scenes actively trying to bring awareness to this topic. There have been people like Steve Bassett and Paradigm Research who much like Dr. Stephen Greer, things like that, much like Dr. Lear, have been foot forward for decades.
Yes, absolutely.
Talking with members of Congress, senators, all kinds of things to rally on our behalf. And even the slight UFO UAP panels that we had were groundbreaking in what was said and what was discovered.
I just finished reading a book called UFO Contact from the Pleiades by Britt Elders.
Okay.
Britt Elders is going to be on my own podcast every Thursday night. She'll be on a week from this Thursday, the 11th. And Britt is a member of HDA. Britt and her late husband, Lee, as you know, studied Billy Meyer's case in Switzerland for years and years and years. Yep. In the 70s. And my God, Chris, when you look at the photos in this book, they are crystal clear, sharp, of four different kinds of UFO craft that Billy Meyer shot from 75 into the 1980s. And these are real. And these are real. These photos were studied. The audio recordings Billy Meyer made were studied. Pieces of metal that Billy Meyer gave Lee and Britt Elder for analysis were studied. No one could figure out these UFOs that were photographed. These were not models. These were not models on strings. The man had one arm, and he's up in the mountains in Switzerland, and he's shooting magnificent craft 50 to 100, 300 feet away. And they're crystal clear, perfectly sharp. And these photos have been validated. And my question is, why does the world, and why is this not on the front page of the New York Times? Why does the world not know? I've heard about Billy Meyer for 20 years. Mm. And I'm like, and I personally always heard, yeah, he was a con man. He had UFOs on you know, wires, or he'd throw a Frisbee in the air. And I'm thinking, that's what I heard. And I just read this book, and I'm going to interview Britt next week. And I'm like, my God, how is this not common knowledge?
Well, and you know, that is a topic that we discuss regularly on the show, Dan. As somebody who's worked in mainstream and sidestream media, technology is not sexy.
And
it's sad that to the average person, a headline like, you know, CERN turns matter into light, like that should not be on your way out to commercial break. You know, like, and when we come back from these coffee break commercials, Like, it's always scooped to the side. And it's interesting to see that. Now, you know, there are great people like Alan Alda out there who is doing some great work right now with his institute, helping scientists learn to speak non-science so that they can actively, like, hey, billionaire who wants to invest in something, here's a good science idea that'll help humanity. If you don't know how to put that into a 3-minute elevator pitch, you don't know how to talk to a billionaire who can fund you, you know? And it's interesting because it's very much the same way in our community in how you talk to an experiencer, how you get them to be comfortable talking about their experience frequently. And even getting people to understand how to communicate with science. You know, it wasn't really until the reclassification. I know a lot of people in the communities don't like UAP. The only reason I like it is because it made science go, well, technically phenomena is right there in the scientific method.
You know? Steve Bassett was one of the people that helped. He told me this to my face, that he helped. He was one of the people who came up with and helped promote UAP.
Yeah.
Because he feels it takes away, you know, UFO is the day the earth stood still, 1950, Robert Wise movie. That's a UFO flying saucer.
It's in a Kleenex box.
Yeah. UAP.
That's what
Ryan Graves and Grush and Fravor and Congress. Yeah. And Congress is asking about UAPs. It just that term. And listen, it's just three letters. But the term has elevated and taken away a lot of the stigma. It's made it more palatable.
Yeah.
That now most people know UFOs and UAPs are synonymous. But to the world at large, it's like the new and improved term. In fact, there's a clip of Hillary Clinton on Jimmy Kimmel, and Kimmel goes, Mrs. Clinton, if you become president, you'll look into UFOs, right? And he goes, no, Jimmy, it's UAPs now.
Yeah.
So it has elevated the concept away from Little Green Men and classic flying saucers.
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's exactly what NASA said in their first panel, was that the reclassification of this brings it directly into the purview of science. Our job is to eliminate phenomena from our data set.
And since the term came along in the last several years, the media have been showing more and more UFO reports on the news, and the best part is they're chuckling less.
Yes.
They're making little green men jokes less. They still are, but less. They're like, a UFO was reported, or UAP was reported over Denver, and they'll show a clip, and then they're not laughing like in the past. Like they think we're all bat S-word crazy. And
you actively have new books out right now. Let's get into those a little bit, Dan.
Sure. In the last three weeks, and I timed these to coincide with, I just turned 68 years old on June 17th, right after contact. I came back from contact and I turned 68. And I had two books lined up that I've written in the last 2 years, and they're right behind me here. One is called My Paranormal Life, Supernatural Stories from a Hollywood Insider. That's my paranormal memoir, I'm calling it. Mm. Those are real life stories, Chris, that I've been having in the back of my head, man, my whole life. Ghosts, poltergeists, angelic voices, spirit guides, remarkable coincidences, things that have happened in my life.
Yeah.
That are very, very hard to explain other than to say that it was a paranormal experience. And people are loving this book. It came out May 4th, so about a month and a half ago.
All right.
And just some quick stories. When I was 5 years old, I remembered this my whole life, but I never wrote it down. When I was 5 years old, I was climbing up a very tall billboard sign in my hometown in New Jersey with two little girlfriends I had, neighbors. And I'm 5 years old, I had to be a 30-foot tall billboard sign. We climbed up this sign. I fell off, Chris, from the top of the sign, flew through the air on my back looking up at the sky. And I remember this vividly, thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to die. And I'm five. I'm falling through the air in slow motion, looking up at the sky. I wake up. I don't know how much time. I actually have missing time here. I woke up. I don't know how much longer. In a stranger's house, two blocks away from my parents' house, on a couch. I wake up. I sit up. I'm five. I'm looking around. I said, hello, hello, anyone here? No one was home. No one was there.
Whoa.
And I'm thinking, how did I get here? It wasn't the two little girls that had I was playing with, my next door neighbors. They would have been there. And then his best part, and this is all true, man. It's a vivid memory. I stood up. I looked to the right. In front of the door, front door of this house, was a 7 foot tall creature. It was white chocolate in color. It had the face of a bull. It had the body of sort of the body of an angel, but the wings, here's what I remember vividly. The wings, where the wings would have been, were bones, bony stumps. It's like wow. God had taken a hedge clippers and cut off these wings. So the wings should have been there, but they were cut off. And it had the face of a bull. It turned around and it snorted at me. And I looked at it and I thought to myself, he doesn't like me. And then it vanished. It dissipated through the screen door. And that was it. And I walked home and then that was it. I told my mother this story. Why didn't you tell me this story? I go, Mom, I was 5 years old. I'm supposed to tell you I saw a gargoyle save my life when I was 5 years old. So I think, I know this is crazy, but I think something remarkable happened. When I fell off that sign at five, did I die? I have no idea. I don't know if I died and came back. Was I taken? Was I abducted? I believe that that gargoyle creature saved my life and brought me to this home. This is a stranger's home. To this day, I don't know where he took me to. And no one was even home. Where I lived, you didn't leave the house unlocked. No one was home. So I think something remarkable happened at a very young age that took me onto the other side. Because since then, I've had ghosts and poltergeists, and I've heard voices in my right ear countless times tell me things to do. And every time it's told me something to do, I did it and it came true and it worked out to my advantage. So I think that's when my paranormal life began, after I fell off that sign.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Is that a crazy story? Is that a crazy story?
Yes and no, Dan, because I mean, quite honestly, my listening audience knows I've told the story here. I've told it on other shows. My first paranormal experience was looking out, and I remember being about four and a half years old. We lived in a little trailer house. Back behind us was Pat's house, where I would go during the day, help her get chicken. She'd take care of me while my mom was at work. And there was an old swing set, like a tetanus 1970s swing set. With the facing swing bench on it. And leaning out next to that was a dark, shadowy figure with wings, a tail, and horns that was beckoning for me to come outside.
Really?
Wow. First vivid memory that I have in my life. Not even joking.
I totally believe you. I do. What do you think? Was that a devil or was that a gargoyle? I don't know.
And once again, I've even thrown up the fact of like, hey, it was like 1980s. Like there were definitely the deviled ham commercials, things like that. Who knows what was tropely stuck in my head? But there was this shadowy figure that was beckoning for me to come outside. I don't know if beckoning me to come out in a protective way, beckoning for me to come out in a, come here, I got something to show you.
Hey,
like,
kid, yeah.
Give me your consent kind of way, you know?
Chris, that's a hell of a story. So clearly this thing was not human, but do you think it was an extraterrestrial being of some kind?
It was definitely not from here. that was definitely the vibe that I got at the age that I was. I don't think I had a distinction between, I don't think like my son has a distinction between these things because of the things I'm into.
Yeah, I can imagine.
The shows he's come in that I'm watching, like, oh, what's Bigfoot? Well, okay. Well, let's get into the conversation.
By the way, I love Bigfoot. how could Bigfoot not be real? Seriously, it's been seen around the world a million times for, what, 1,000 years?
Yeah.
Of course it's real. The question is, what is it?
Well,
and when are we going to meet one? Of course the phenomenon is real.
And these gargoyle-type creatures seen in your experience and in my experience are creatures that have been seen by other people. I've had shadow person experiences. It's interesting once you've touched that paranormal side, Dan, I truly believe that it's very much like a magnet to a watch, you know, there's always a little bit of that magnet with the watch from that point forward.
Well, I think what's very, very cool is, so in 2007, I began studying ufology seriously and deeply and intensely. And then my book, my UFO book came out last year. But I've met so many people that have had, like I said earlier, remarkable experiences. But I think, Chris, what's happening is, for example, you and I are friends now, man. I mean, you and I have found each other. Earl Grey is literally one of my best friends. I have dinner with him. Nick Pope is one of my best friends.
Yeah.
When he's in LA, we have dinner. We, those of us who are open-minded and open-hearted, I say if you have an open heart and open mind, we are, and the HDA, perfect example, mm-hmm. 150, 200 people, total strangers, right? Most of the people in my group never even knew each other. Most of these people, I mean, some of them knew each other, but Stephen Bassett and I were the catalyst to bring together many, many disparate people.
Yeah.
Under one roof. We are finding each other. We are creating our own communities. That's what HDA is. It's really a community. And it's been an honor for me to be part of something where people with like-minded experiences and open mind, you know, when you go to a MUFON meeting or an HDA event and you tell remarkable stories, people don't go, oh, you know, BS, that's BS. People are like, come up to you afterwards, tell me more. What did the creature look like? How tall was? These are people who are really into this whole thing. Same with contact in the desert. I had people coming up to me talking about my dad and working on UFOs, and people were asking me questions and really good questions too. So we are finding each other. And people like you are helping with your outreach to coalesce these different groups together.
Well, and books like yours, Dan, not only the After They Came, which we had you on about the first time, but your new one, My Paranormal Life, the idea that these things happen throughout your life if you're open to seeing the fact that they may have. If you're open to realizing that, and once again, getting people comfortable with that conversation, getting them okay with being able to tell their story, being able to recount something that, hey, you know, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, but when I was 8, I remember this.
Exactly right. I interviewed Earl Anderson last week, and did he tell you his story when he was 3 in the car? When he was 3 in a car, and he almost something supernatural took him out of the car. His parents' car crashed hard, and he was by the back window, back seat, and his father's medical machine was behind him. Something took him through the window and placed him gently on the ground. Had he stayed in the car, he would have been crushed by this huge medical machine. He told me this story the other day. He was 3. And he said, Dan, I call it my miracle story. An angel or an alien or somebody literally saved my life, pulled me out of the car through a closed window, I might add.
Wow.
So like you said, you know, my gargoyle, I was 5. Earl was 3. An angel saved him at 3. This stuff happens. These things really happen. And the more they're discussed and brought out into open, more people will be less harsh with their criticism.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's just it. It's about being able to open and broach the conversation, being able to have the conversation and, you know, letting people understand. It's a very intimate look into your life, Dan, even the idea
it is. Yeah. I mean,
during COVID,
I wrote 5 books during COVID because I was bored. This was my catch-all. This book was my kitchen sink. Three UFO sightings in detail. After my dad passed away, I was very close to my dad. He visited me four times in my bedroom, four times. The first time he spoke to me with words. And then the other times he turned lights on and off. He was playing my drum set in my bedroom in the middle of the night. My dad was very spiritually drawn to me from the other side. Right after he died, Chris, within the 2-3 weeks after he died, my dad kept coming into my room, man. And then it stopped. 20 years ago, I had my dead grandfather was a poltergeist in my house. That's a whole chapter in my book. Things were flying around my house. Things were flying. Doors were slamming. I once accidentally lit a bunch of matches by the fireplace too quickly. In my hand, I had a torch of fireplace matches, those tall, tall decorative matches, 50 of them. They lit by accident in my hand. And I stood there thinking my face is going to catch fire. And this bluish white mist from the dining room flew through the air. And it was like Casper the Friendly Ghost without a face, flew through the air fast, grabbed this torch of matches, lit matches, grabbed it out of my hand and threw it into the fireplace so my eyebrows wouldn't catch on fire. I swear to God, that's a true story. I looked, I'm like, what the hell was that? Because I felt it pulled the thing out of my hand. Long story short, we did my kids and my girlfriend, and we did a Ouija board. After 3 months of weird things happening, doors slamming, glasses breaking, things flying around the house. We did a Ouija board. On the Ouija board, and I caution people with Ouija boards, you have to be careful.
Yeah.
But we sat around with the planchette, the thing that moves, and I said, is there a ghost in my house? Yes, right away, yes. What's your name? Joseph. Okay. Where are you from, Joseph? Chris, it wrote Syria. My grandfather was from Syria, because I have chills right now telling you. No, but my kids and my girlfriend, they didn't know that. I wasn't moving the planchette. Syria. Are you my grandpa Joe? Yes. My grandpa Joe died in 1967. This is the year 2003, okay? Then I said, Grandpa Joe, what are you doing here? And it wrote, to teach. I said, what do you want to teach? Then it wrote, Jordan. J-O-R-D. That's my son's name. My son was there.
Oh,
Jordan,
wow.
What do you want to teach Jordan? And then it wrote something. He was an Orthodox Jewish cantor. It wrote a sentence in Hebrew, Chris. It wrote a sentence in Hebrew. And I later had the sentence translated. The sentence was, I am sorry. I am a stranger here. I am a stranger here. So I start crying because I love my grandpa Joe died. I was 11. I said, Grandpa, I love you, man. I said, but you got to stop. You got to leave my house. You're scaring us, because it was slamming doors and stuff.
Yeah.
You're scaring. Please leave. Chris, then the thing went, yes. The planchette went, yes. That was it. Nothing ever happened ever again. I was there for another year. Nothing ever happened.
Wow. Wow.
It was my Grandpa Joe. And the guy died in 1967. This is how many decades later. So this is the first paragraph right here in my blurb. When that happened to me, I realized that supernatural stuff can really happen to normal people in everyday life. That's when I realized there's something going on, man.
Well, and, you know, more and more, especially talking to people like Les Velez from Opus, things like that, it is interesting to see the crossover of phenomenologies, Dan. Even whenever you talked about, you know, your love for Bigfoot a minute ago, the idea that Bigfoot and UFOs are now crossing paths, and portals, things like that. And it's like, we've got to be able to open the conversation. I know that for some people, it may be a fantastical conversation. All right. But at some point, entertaining the idea of the mythical lowland gorilla over tea and crumpets was, you know, like that was farcical and mythical too, until 70 years after we actively discovered that the thing was real.
Do you watch the Secret of Skinwalker Ranch?
I do.
Watch that?
I do.
Right, so Did you see, I'm sure you did, this season, they have a dead cow bone that had been bitten through with a tooth. And the only explanation is a dire wolf. Dire wolves have been gone for tens of thousands of years, and it's the only explanation. So I watch that show every religiously with my daughter. We love it.
It's pretty wild. There are stories of a dire wolf being on property. At least that's what the people called it.
Because it was a dire wolf coming. Yeah, the skinwalker is a shape-shifting thing, like a man wolf, and maybe it's this dire wolf, and maybe it's coming from, you know, they've proven there's a portal above the triangle. There is definitely something there.
You know, from the readings that are there, and I'm a big proponent of it is more than likely basically like a radar reflection, like an electromagnetic reflection of a high iridium meteorite underneath that area.
Interesting. Is that what you think it is?
That's what I think it is. It's basically like a projected electromagnetic field.
My daughter and I think it's a crashed UFO craft that broke into it because they call it a debris field under there. I think it's chunks of a craft that still is perhaps signaling, you know, ET call home, because they always get that 1.6 gigahertz signal every time they're there. It's like this craft is like, help, find me. We've been buried for 2,000 years. Come get us.
But even then, you know, to bring this back to the Disclosure Alliance, back to books, back to the paranormal, and back to understanding that there may be a connection between these things, between other paranormal spots and UFO, UAP activity, between people's paranormal experiences. It's even interesting to see some of the work of Kathleen Martin and where it has gone with experiencers and some of the abilities that they come back having, you know? It's interesting.
People have been asking me, I'll ask you your opinion on this, recently, because I have seen enough. I've seen four UFOs. The last one was a contact.
Yeah.
So I've had ghosts and I've seen UFOs. I've not seen aliens, but I did see a gargoyle, whatever he was. But people have been asking me, Dan, do you think extraterrestrials and ghosts are somehow related? Now, I think that's a really great question. And my answer, Chris, see if you agree. My answer is, well, both are interdimensional beings. They're both interdimensional. Because I know my father visited me. I know four times. I know it was him because he told me, and I know it was him. Yeah. My father visited me four times after he died in my bedroom. Well, he was dead. So that's interdimensional. Clearly, it has to be. I've not seen an extraterrestrial being, but people have. And people have had experiences with them and touched them and talked to them. Goldie Hawn, do you know that story?
Yeah.
She saw one when she was 21.
Her and Kurt Russell are dream interviews.
I know. They're on my dream interview list. I know. We want $150,000 to walk across the street to shake your hand. Everything with them is money. But I would say, clearly, some ETs are interdimensional.
Yeah.
Some are from other planets, star systems, or galaxies. Some live under the oceans in the U.S. and on the planet Earth. Some, I think, are time travelers, and I love that one because if they're us from the future, wouldn't we go back to watch Christopher Columbus?
I'm a big fan of the work of Dr. Michael P. Masters, which very much extrapolates out the fact that yes, you know, especially the Greys, things like that, may very well be us from the future, especially when you start looking at the very AI concept of them. When you start looking at the questions that they ask, they're very, very interested in DNA, things like that. They're very, very interested in giving the message of stop using nuclear weapons. So could it be the fact that it's us from the future coming back, trying to gather information and figure out what we did?
And maybe try to knowing our present is their past. So knowing, let's say, God forbid, the year 2035, we blow each other up and it's the end of the earth because of nuclear whatever. Yeah. Maybe they're coming back and saying, hey, you guys, you know, you don't have much longer. You need to steer the ship better because we know what's Yeah. See, that's why if they were to reveal themselves, Chris, and tell us, were you from the future? We know what's going to happen on this date in the future. You guys are going to destroy each other. I think we would. The shit would be scared out of all of us on yes. Earth. We go, oh my God! If they're telling us, well, they know this is going to be true. Maybe we should start re-steering the ship of planet Earth better.
Well, and you know, really trying to make those human connections of empathy across the board with each other better.
Yeah,
Dan.
Yeah, but now, yeah, but look at. I mean, I don't want to get into politics, but you know, Donald Trump is not the most pleasant man, and
yeah,
you know, he's all about anger and hatred and violence.
And you know, even the whole concept of being locked into a negative news cycle to begin with, you know, being locked into just a constant state of negativity and panic.
Especially since the debate, I know it's been very.
Oh goodness!
Where is JFK or Reagan or
couldn't
or,
we just an, ask an them orator, questions a, about what, aliens?
Clinton, Obama. Where is a leader yeah. to rise from the ashes and say, "Look, you know, America's not doing real well. I'm 45, like not Gavin Newsom, but a young, energetic guy who is intelligent, who could perhaps lead us." Take the ball forward, not two old men who want to go backwards in time. It just doesn't make any sense, you know?
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And it's one of those, like, even my wife and I were talking today, like, we really need people who at least have one kid, like one actual child, so that yeah. you understand the impact of what's being built. So it's always right there in your face. Like grandchildren off in the distance are cool, you know, but no, like we need a little bit more connection, and we need a little more connection across the board, period, Dan. Even whenever Absolutely. It comes to people's experiences, even whenever it comes to understanding somebody's paranormal life, you know, these are experiences that change people. These are experiences that I love the term that Earl Grey and Kathleen Martin used, the, you know, the ontologic shock, the fact that everything that you know to be and believe changes on the head of a dime when one of these experiences happens to you. And that can be hard to express to friends. It can be hard to express to family, much less if there's any kind of, you know, very personal things that happen in an abduction experience, things like that. So even opening the conversation with books like yours to let people know that, like, hey, I had these experiences happen in my life, too, you know?
Absolutely. I had a good talk with Katie Page when she was on my panel at Contact. Mm-hmm. Katie, I said, Katie, how do you, you know, you've had so many experiences as a young child and as a young teen. She was on a ranch in Colorado. That preceded in fame, preceded Skinwalker Ranch. Mm. And she had all kinds of weird and not pleasant things happen to her. I don't know if you ever interviewed Katie Page. But not I said, yet. How do you talk to people who don't believe you? She goes, I tell my truth. I tell my stories. I'm explaining what happened to me. I'm not espousing my beliefs on anyone. I'm not making you have yeah. to believe me. I'm telling you my truth. And if... hopefully you'll be understanding to my stories. And if not, then Dave Foley interjected. He goes, and if not, find other friends. That's what he said. If yeah. not, find other friends.
Yeah.
And I thought that was the perfect answer. Walk away, find someone who will have a yeah. conversation with you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely. Yeah. You know, because it is the fact of, we talk about it regularly on the show, the idea that, there is not only the want of confirmation there for people, but a lot of fear when it comes for it as well, you know. So finding a community of people that are accepting, finding a community of people that are empathetic to what has happened to you is so important. So important.
That's a really good word, empathetic. And again, HollywoodDisclosureAlliance.org, that's what we're about, man. Nobody makes fun of anybody. And there are some crazy stories going on in that with our people.
Well, it's amazing. Here in the last couple minutes,
Oh, can I push my other book, Five? Can
I absolutely. Mention my book? I was just about to say, let's get into Five for about 5 minutes or so. I want to hear your experience story from Contact.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right, let me talk about Five. So yeah. Five just came out the other day, literally the day before my birthday. It was June 17th. Five, here's what that was. I walk 5 miles for exercise. I walk 5 miles every other day through Beverly Hills and West Hollywood where I live. And since COVID in the last 4 years. So every other day, 5 miles. So I'm just one day last year, I'm thinking five miles, or just the word five. I'm like, I really like that word five. What is that? What could that be? And then I was thinking that would be a cool nickname if someone's name was Five, like their nickname. And then I'm like, well, what would the real name be if that was your nickname? So the only thing I come up with was Fivel.
Sure.
Okay. So now I'm thinking, okay, Fivel. Now I have Fivel. His nickname is Five. Who is Fivel? Now, Chris, the craziest thing. I worked with Bruce Springsteen when I was 16 years old in 1973. That's in my first book, Flirting with Fame. And I'm thinking out of nowhere, what if Bruce Springsteen was a serial killer? Is that just insane? What if a world's famous, beloved pop or rock music star, right? Plays concerts, hundreds of thousands of people. People go crying. They love him, crying. They're so happy to see. And then after the concert, everyone calms down. He gets in his car and he drives around at night and he kills and he murders women. And no one knows that Bruce Springsteen's a serial killer. So I'm like, I have five-fold. Bruce Springsteen's a mass murderer. I'm like, how do I weave that? So the premise for Five is in 1870s Europe, a man named Fivel is a famous actor on the Hungarian theater. But for reasons you have to read the book, he becomes very distressed when he learns how his parents were murdered, and he becomes a serial killer. In 1870s Europe, this famous actor, Fivel, his nickname is Five, starts killing women in evil ways. Okay. Then he's murdered. When he's captured, he's murdered and he dies. 100 years later, a young kid named Billy Simon, who's from Boston, is a teenage musical prodigy. He's a singer, songwriter, guitarist. He's incredibly handsome. He has the voice of an angel and he writes songs that make women cry. So in my book, 100 years later, this kid, Billy Simon, goes to Manhattan with his girlfriend, gets discovered. The agent, a legendary agent in Manhattan, makes him the world's biggest pop star. Okay. Unbeknownst to him, when he was a little kid, he inherited, became the reincarnation.
Oh no.
Of the first guy. So it's a serial killer who dies, and 100 years later, he's reincarnated at the biggest pop music star in the world, but he's still a serial killer. And that's what Five is. It just came out of me. I wrote it in like 4 months. It just spilled out. And it just came out the other day.
That is fantastic. And what a birthday gift for yourself to,
it really
to be
was.
Able to
that's
get
exactly
something
really
like that
was.
off the project bench. And I love it.
And I did George Norrie's show 2 days after my birthday to promote awesome. Both my new books. I said, George, you're my birthday present to myself.
That's great.
I thought that was pretty cool.
That is epic.
By the last night of Contact, June 2nd, 3rd, June 2nd. Okay. June 2nd, Sunday night at Contact, they had a CE5. You know what a CE5 event is. It's the first time I'd been there. My friends Serena DC and Michael Mazzola ran a CE5 event, and they studied at the feet of Stephen Greer. They studied CE5 events for years with Stephen Greer. So they did one at Contact, about 200 people. 9 p.m. it started out on the lawn near the pool. We're all holding hands, 200 people, looking up at the sky, crystal clear sky because it's Palm Springs.
Yeah.
Beautiful, nice, warm night, and we're looking up, and it's like, the leaders are saying, hello, space brothers. Well, we love you. We're sending good vibes. We want to meet you. So our hearts are open. Our minds are open. Please communicate with us. We want so much to meet you. We want to see you. Please come and talk to us. So that was from 9 till 10:30 p.m. And it was very cool, Chris. I thought, this is really quite lovely. I'm an open-minded person. I didn't think in a million years something would happen. Honest to God, I thought this is very sweet. It was like a kumbaya campfire kind of thing, right? So from 9 to 10:30, we're holding hands, looking up. And after a while, you know, your neck hurts when you're looking up at the sky for 2 hours. So I laid on the ground. Now it's 10:30. People start to lay on the ground because we didn't want to stand anymore.
Yeah.
And then and they're saying, come on, you know, please show yourselves. Please, we want to see you. I'm looking up at God's my witness. We heard a boom. There was a boom in the sky, not super loud, but it was like a boom. And out of nowhere, a V, 300 feet in the air, a V craft came out of the puff of smoke in the sky. A V craft came over our heads rather quickly. It was rounded. It was a V, but it had rounded tips. Each of the three tips of the V was rounded. It was white, vanilla white color, ice cream color. With you ever see vanilla ice cream with a caramel ribbon?
Yeah,
caramel gold ribbon. It was vanilla white with caramel ribbon color. Gorgeous. It was gorgeous. And the best part, Chris, it was a V. Under each wing of the V were three suction cups, octopus suction cups. I swear to you, I swear on my daughter, I'm telling you the truth.
Wow.
Three octopus suction cups. They were lit up, same color, white and gold. And they were going like this. They were pulsing. These octopus suction cups were pulsing. And I thought to myself, that thing's alive. So it looked like it was a V craft on top of some living entity because it was pulsing. It looked like a heartbeat, like bum, bum.
Wow.
And all of these octopus discs were thumping. They were throbbing. And I'm like, oh my God, that's the most incredible thing I've ever. That was the last day of contact. So people, we all applauded, you know. And then I went to bed and I was walking to the room. People, can you believe that? Wasn't that great? Wasn't that beautiful? I'm like, yeah, that was my fourth UFO. I mean, I didn't even think that was going to happen.
That is incredible.
It was a great way to end contact.
I've got the CE5 app. There's a community here in Austin. I have highly considered getting involved and going to some things.
I wasn't expecting anything, honestly, Dan, and it happened.
It's honestly one of those, and I've talked about it on the show. I'm a little wary, mainly for the aspect that is very similar to a Ouija board. You know, now granted, my intent is good. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to scry any answers to the future or anything like that or practice any necromancy. However, I am putting an intent and an invitation out there, you know, and that's holding a big tater on a corner parapsychologically. You know what I mean?
I felt elated when I saw that UFO. I felt
that's
elated.
Incredible. That's incredible.
And I could still feel it. Now it was visually beautiful.
Wow.
It was pleasing to look at with my eyes. It was, I'm telling you, 12 seconds at the most, 12 seconds.
Wow. But, that is and a long experience though.
I'm going to say 12 seconds, if that long. And you're thinking, get your camera, take a picture. If I had
not
done
in
that,
12
I
seconds,
missed,
not
missed,
in, it it, within 5 seconds, you still haven't fully functionally realized what the hell you're looking at.
By this time, I saw what it was 2 seconds, 3 seconds later, it's gone.
Yeah.
So there's no way to get a picture.
And it's interesting, Dan, to even talk about that. The idea that like you think I'd have my camera out immediately. No, man,
I had it in my hand. Chris, I had it in my hand for an hour and a half.
I'm taking
pictures of the sky every so often, just random.
Yeah.
But in those 12 seconds, I didn't have it in my hand. And that's what had happened.
Wow. Wow. What an incredible experience. And to have that experience with other witnesses, with other people.
Who really wanted it to happen. And several friends of mine were in that crowd. It was a communal, warm, lovely thing. It happened on the last night.
That's beautiful.
I'm asking Michael Mazzola because he filmed it. I'm trying to get film footage. I would love to see if he got that on film.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you asked me a minute ago about what I believe about craft, paranormal, things like that. I am a big believer in vibration, Dan, by all grades. Of all classes that I made decent grades in, it was science. And I remember very distinctly learning in like ninth grade, we are all 90% empty space. By all atomic measure, everything else, we're you and I right now, despite the vast distance between California and Austin, Texas, we're sharing an electron shell by all of that chemistry that I learned in high school, you know. We are a conscious individual vibration, and that energy, once created by physics, cannot be destroyed. It can only change form. So I choose to see it as the fact of an octave of music, what have you. We are consciously attracting this physical matter right now and moving to the next vibrational level. You know, a three-dimensional object leaves a two-dimensional shadow, and a four-dimensional object leaves a three-dimensional shadow.
That's a good line. So, I agree.
It's one of those, like, all we do is vibrate one octave higher and move into the next range. That's all. We are just adjunct in the universe. That's for me the source of paranormal, especially whenever you're talking UFO experience and whenever you're talking extreme UFO contact, you know, to bend space and time, to travel through a stable wormhole, things like that, would require an incredible electromagnetic field and some incredible technologies that would require very high vibrational rates. And much like standing near a microwave dish at a broadcast station where it says, don't stand near this, right. There's reasons for that. It's the vibrations. Take an ear of corn near that and see if you don't end up with popcorn real quick.
Well, Chris, like I said, when at that UFO sighting, there was a bang. There was a bang in the sky. And it wasn't like thunder. It was just loud enough that you'd heard it, but it wasn't a scary. It was like something just, and then there was there was a wisp of smoke. I looked at the source. And then that's where this thing came out of. I mean, it came out of a hole. I'm telling you, it came out of the hole. It wasn't like it was far off because there were 200 people looking at the sky.
Yeah.
We would have seen it. They would have said, look at the left. It's coming, right?
Yeah.
It would have been coming for a while. It just bang, puff of smoke. It appeared and it just shot across the sky and then just vanished. It appeared. It was like, hello. We just wanted to say hello. We were in the neighborhood. All 200 of you guys, we know that you've been praying for to meet us. Here we are.
Yeah.
Well, we got to go. We can't stay. We got to go. I was laying on the ground thinking, before I saw it, I was thinking, if I saw another UFO now, it would be so wonderful. It would be just so great because I worked my ass off at contact. I really did work hard on it. I thought that'd be a treat. Then I was thinking, what would be even greater if something showed up, landed, if it landed for us and said hello, we're whoever we are from Pleiades. And I thought to myself, I know I would just cry. I'd cry hysterically.
Yeah.
I would be so remarkably happy just to have experienced this reality because I know it's real. We all know it's real. Mm. And so I'm thinking, please, I actually was thinking, please show yourselves. I'd love to see you. Please consider landing. I'd love to meet you. And I'm a semi-skeptical person. And when I saw this show up, as I'm putting out those vibes, I'm thinking there's really something to the CE5. It's a real thing. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I really was.
Once again, I believe that much like any mass meditation initiative, things like that, that is an intentional shift of vibration, you know? That rings out like a resounding gong when that happens. When so many
creatures
people
and whoever that was in that craft, and this was not a Chinese weather balloon, man.
Wow,
this was not a Chinese weather, and I don't think this was military. I don't think military.
Damn,
octopus suction cups that are vibrating.
That is beautiful.
Pulsing. I don't think that was a military Chinese craft.
That's beautiful though, and what an incredible experience. And once again, just proof to the fact of you were there with phone in hand. Once again, it's weird because people don't understand the rapidity with which it happens, but also the fact that 12 seconds is a good sighting. That's prime example. hold your breath for 12 seconds, sit in 12 seconds of silence on a broadcast and see if you don't get antsy.
It was enough to see it very, very clearly.
Wow.
I it's imprinted. I see it right now. I can see it right now. It was crystal clear. It was low to the ground. I described it exactly like I said. The colors were unreal. The vanilla with the caramel swirl.
Wow.
Usually a craft is silver or it's black or clear or whatever, metallic. This looked like ice cream, like flying octopus ice cream is the best way.
Wow.
I never even knew a craft could be visually beautiful in color. I never knew that before.
Incredible, Dan. Incredible. What an amazing experience. And I can't wait to read more about the other experiences that you have had in your life and My Paranormal Life, Supernatural Stories from a Hollywood Insider, as well as the amazing new book, Five, a novella. That sounds really, really cool.
Thanks. I think Five is, do you remember, I know we have to wrap. Do you remember the Rod Serling show, The Night Gallery?
Oh yeah. Loved it.
Well, I loved that show, man. The Night Gallery it was a 1 hour anthology show. You know, each week it was a different short story. They were all creepy and weird and disturbing. Some of them.
Yeah, it was really precursor to things like Tales from the Dark Side. Tales from the Crypt, all that kind of good stuff.
It was Rod Serling's. It was after Twilight Zone.
Yep.
But before Freddy Krueger and hardcore, you know, murder.
Yeah,
stabbings
before
and
gore.
It was like the early 70s that show was on. So my Five book. And in fact, I'm having dinner with a Hollywood agent on the 16th of July. I'm going to hand him Five, and I'm going to say, "Look, this is a 1 hour anthology TV show short story. It's a short story, and there's a lot in there and it's a lot of creepy weirdness, but I have really good characters. I have really good settings. I'm very good with dialogue. And the people that have read it so far said, Dan, man, there's something screwed up in your life, but this would be a hell of a good TV show. So I'm hoping that's what happened.
Absolutely. Well, Dan, thank you so much as always for coming on. Before we let you go, one last time, let everybody know where they can go to find out more about the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance, if they are a member of the media, where they can go to become involved, all that kind of good stuff.
Sure. Thank you very much, man. So HollywoodDisclosureAlliance.org is our website. Everything is there. We are open to new members on two fronts, UFO or UAP experiencers, researchers, authors, and disclosure advocates. I mean, we have Steve Bassett, we have Danny Sheehan, we have two of the top disclosure advocates in the world already. Yep. And if you're on the Hollywood side, and Hollywood means the entertainment industry, and there you go.
Hey, that's me.
We just added that today, I think. Hollywood means the global entertainment industry.
Yeah.
Writers, producers, directors, performers. We have several movie stars. Shirley MacLaine is a member. So we are melding these two disparate groups together. I call it chocolate and peanut butter. It works good together. If you go to the contact page, you'll get me. If you go to the donate page, I always get that confused with the word donut. Donate page. We are a nonprofit, 501c3. We are seeking donations. We are going to be beginning a monthly live events. We're going to start publishing our own newsletter, and we want to do an annual award show as well.
Oh, fantastic.
So we need donations. So on that website, if you click the donate page, you'll see that. And then for me personally, for my books, danhararyauthor.com, danhararyauthor.com. All my books are up there, the background, history, and photos, all my books. And you could buy them there, and you could write to me as well. I'd love to hear from people. And Chris, thanks, man. It's always fun talking to you. I really appreciate this, man.
Absolutely. Anytime and always, I am here to help and have these conversations because, I mean, your experience at Contact is absolutely beautiful and quite literally brought me to the point of I think I will contact my local CE5 chapter and see what I can go to do to have one of those experiences.
I inspired you. Yeah, let me know what happens. Absolutely.
Well, I've heard experiences from a few people, but this one takes the cake, man. Amongst everything, it takes the cake.
Chris, honestly, when I went to hang with some friends. It was the last night of Contact. I'd had a few drinks with a friend at dinner, and I'm holding people's hands, and I'm thinking, this is really lovely. It's really nice. this is a real community, right?
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. It's Palm Springs in June. I mean, it's gorgeous, beautiful.
Yeah.
And honest to God, in a million years, I didn't think anything was going to happen. I didn't, because from 9 to 10:30, an hour and a half, absolutely nothing happened. And wow. I'm looking at my watch, you know, like, okay, but if nothing happens by 11, because I have an early morning, I'm going to have to go leave this. And then this thing showed up. Hello, we're here. We love you. Take care. Got to go. And it just, people applauded. You know, people cheered. It was like, wow, holy God, this really happened. It was wonderful. Really
That's
wonderful.
Amazing. Amazing. Absolutely awesome. Dan, once again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your candid candor on such an important topic, the relation between experiencers and media and the media and the public and the government. So
thank you very much. Any way we can promote disclosure through the media, that's what HDA is all about. And welcome, and I'm going to send you the Slack invite so you'll be able to share your stories with the rest of our members, Chris.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from Dan Hariri as well as Hollywood Disclosure Alliance, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can find Dan Hariri's book, as well as the brand new Field Observation and Encounter Log, folks. If you are out in the field as a paranormal investigator, if you're out in the field as a cryptozoologist or a UFO UAP field investigator, stop on by Amazon, stop on by CuriousRealm.com/store. Get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log today. It is a great way to gather all of your data in one place for comparison, contrast, as well as being able to record it as it happens to you in the field, which, as any investigator will tell you, is the invaluable data to be able to get those experiences written down as fast as possible. So thank you so much, everybody, for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, we do not march forward into humanity. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.